Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, written and read by Douglas Adams. Chapter 1. This time there would be no witnesses. This time there was just the dead earth, a rumble of thunder, and the onset of that interminable light drizzle from the northeast by which so many of the world's most momentous events seem to be accompanied. The storms of the day before and of the day before that, and the floods of the previous week, had now abated. The sky still bulged with rain, but all that actually fell in the gathering evening gloom was a dreary kind of prickle. Some wind whipped across the darkening plain, blundered through the low hills, and gusted across a shallow valley, where stood a structure, a kind of tower, alone in a nightmare of mud, and leaning. It was a blackened stump of a tower. It stood like an extrusion of magma from one of the more pestilential pits of hell, and it leaned at a peculiar angle, as if oppressed by something altogether more terrible than its own considerable weight. It seemed a dead thing, long ages dead. The only movement was that of a river of mud that moved sluggishly along the bottom of the valley past the tower. A mile or so further on, the river ran down a ravine and disappeared underground. But as the evening darkened, it became apparent that the tower was not entirely without life. There was a single, dim, red light guttering deep within it. The light was only just visible, except, of course, that there was no one to see, no witnesses, not this time, but it was nevertheless a light. Every few minutes it grew a little stronger and a little brighter, and then faded slowly away, almost to nothing. At the same time, a low keening noise drifted out on the wind, built up to a kind of wailing climax, and then it too faded abjectly away. Time passed, and then another light appeared, a smaller mobile light. It emerged at ground level and moved in a single bobbing circuit of the tower, pausing occasionally on its way around. Then it, and the shadowy figure that could just be discerned carrying it, disappeared inside once more. An hour passed, and by the end of it, the darkness was total. The world seemed dead, the night a blankness. And then the glow appeared again near the tower's peak, this time growing in power more purposefully. It quickly reached the peak of brightness it had previously attained, and then kept going, increasing, increasing. The keening sound that accompanied it rose in pitch and stridency until it became a wailing scream. The scream screamed on and on till it became a blinding noise and the light a deafening redness. Then abruptly both ceased. There was a millisecond of silent darkness. An astonishing pale new light billowed and bulged from deep within the mud beneath the tower. The sky clenched, a mountain of mud convulsed. Earth and sky bellowed at each other. There was a horrible pinkness, a sudden greenness, a lingering orangeness that stained the clouds, and then the light sank, and the night at last was deeply, hideously dark. There was no further sound other than the soft tinkle of water. But in the morning the sun rose with an unaccustomed sparkle on a day that was, or seemed to be, or at least would have seemed to be if there had been anybody there to whom it could seem to be anything at all, warmer, clearer and brighter, an altogether livelier day than any yet known. A clear river ran through the shattered remains of the valley, and time began seriously to pass. Chapter 2. High on a rocky promontory sat an electric monk on a bored horse. From under its rough woven cowl, the monk gazed unblinkingly down into another valley, with which it was having a problem. The day was hot, the sun stood in an empty hazy sky and beat down upon the grey rocks and the scrubby, parched grass. Nothing moved, not even the monk. The horse's tail moved a little, swishing slightly to try and move a little air, but that was all, otherwise nothing moved. The electric monk was a labour-saving device, like a dishwasher or a video recorder. Dishwashers washed tedious dishes for you, thus saving you the bother of washing them yourself. Video recorders watched tedious television for you, thus saving you the bother of looking at it yourself. Electric monks believed things for you, thus saving you what was becoming an increasingly onerous task, that of believing all the things the world expected you to believe. Unfortunately, this electric monk had developed a fault, and had started to believe all kinds of things more or less at random. It was even beginning to believe things that have difficulty believing in Salt Lake City. It had never heard of Salt Lake City, of course, nor had it ever heard of a quinquagillion, which was roughly the number of miles between this valley and the Great Salt Lake of Utah. The problem with the valley was this. The monk currently believed that the valley and everything in the valley and around it, including the monk itself and the monk's horse, was a uniform shade of pale pink. This made for a certain difficulty in distinguishing any one thing from any other thing, and therefore made doing anything or going anywhere impossible, or at least difficult and dangerous. Hence the immobility of the monk and the boredom of the horse, which had had to put up with a lot of silly things in its time, but was secretly of the opinion that this was one of the silliest. How long did the monk believe these things? Well, as far as the monk was concerned, forever. The faith which moves mountains, or at least believes them against all the available evidence to be pink, was a solid and abiding faith, a great rock against which the world could hurl whatever it would, yet it would not be shaken. In practice, the horse knew 24 hours is usually about its lot. So what of this horse, then, that actually held opinions and was sceptical about things? Unusual behaviour for a horse, wasn't it? An unusual horse, perhaps? No. Although it was certainly a handsome and well-built example of its species, it was nonetheless a perfectly ordinary horse, such as convergent evolution has produced in many of the places that life is to be found. They have always understood a great deal more than they let on. It is difficult to be sat on all day, every day, by some other creature, without forming an opinion about them. On the other hand, it is perfectly possible to sit all day, every day, on top of another creature, and not have the slightest thought about them whatsoever. When the early models of these monks were built, it was felt to be important that they be instantly recognisable as artificial objects. There must be no danger of their looking at all like real people. You wouldn't want your video recorder lounging around on the sofa all day while it was watching TV. You wouldn't want it picking its nose, drinking beer, or sending out for pizzas. So the monks were built with an eye for originality of design and also for practical horse-riding ability. This was important. People, and indeed things, looked more sincere on a horse. So two legs were held to be more suitable and cheaper than the more normal primes of 17, 19, or 23. The skin the monks were given was pinkish-looking instead of purple, soft and smooth instead of crenellated. They were also restricted to just the one mouth and nose, but were given instead an additional eye, making for a grand total of two. Strange-looking creature indeed, but truly excellent at believing the most preposterous things. This monk had first gone wrong when it was simply given too much to believe in one day. It was, by mistake, cross-connected to a video recorder that was watching 11 TV channels simultaneously, and this caused it to blow a bank of illogic circuits. The video recorder only had to watch them, of course. It didn't have to believe them all as well. This is why instruction manuals are so important. So, after a hectic week of believing that war was peace, that good was bad, that the moon was made of blue cheese, and that God needed a lot of money sent to a certain box number, the monks started to believe that 35% of all tables were hermaphrodites, and then broke down. The man from the monk shop said that it needed a whole new motherboard, but then pointed out that the new improved Monk Plus models were twice as powerful, had an entirely new multitasking negative capability feature that allowed them to hold up to 16 entirely different and contradictory ideas in memory simultaneously without generating any irritating system errors, were twice as fast and at least three times as glib, and you could have a whole new one for less than the cost of replacing the motherboard of the old model. That was it. Done. The faulty monk was turned out into the desert where it could believe what it liked, including the idea that it had been hard done by. It was allowed to keep its horse because horses were so cheap to make. For a number of days and nights, which it variously believed to be 3, 43, and 598,703, it roamed the desert, putting its simple electric trust in rocks, birds, clouds, and a form of non-existent elephant asparagus, until at last it fetched up here, on this high rock, overlooking a valley that was not, despite the deep fervour of the monk's belief, pink. Not even a little bit. Time passed. Chapter 3. Time passed. Susan waited. The more Susan waited, the more the doorbell didn't ring. Or the phone. She looked at her watch. She felt that now was about the time she could legitimately begin to feel cross. She was cross already, of course, but that had been in her own time, so to speak. They were well and truly into his time now, and even allowing for traffic, mishaps, and general vagueness and dilatoriness, it was now well over half an hour past the time that he had insisted was the latest time they could possibly afford to leave, so she'd better be ready. She tried to worry that something terrible had happened to him, but didn't believe it for a moment. Nothing terrible ever happened to him, though she was beginning to think that it was time it damn well did. If nothing terrible happened to him soon, maybe she'd do it herself. Now, there was an idea. She threw herself crossly into the armchair and watched the news on television. The news made her cross. She flipped the remote control and watched something on another channel for a bit. She didn't know what it was, but it also made her cross. Perhaps she should phone. She was damned if she was going to phone. Perhaps if she phoned, he would phone her at the same moment and not be able to get through. She refused to admit that she'd even thought that. Damn him, where was he? Who cared where he was anyway? She didn't, that was for sure. 3 times in a row he'd done this. 3 times in a row was enough. She angrily flipped channels one more time. There was a program about computers and some interesting new developments of the things you could do with computers and music. That was it. That was really it. She knew that she'd told herself that that was it only seconds earlier, but this was now the final, real, ultimate it. She jumped to her feet and went to the phone, gripping an angry Filofax. She flipped briskly through it and dialed a number. Hello, Michael? Yes, it's Susan, Susan Way. You said I should call you if I was free this evening, and I said I'd rather be dead in a ditch, remember? Well, I suddenly discovered that I am free, absolutely and completely and utterly free, and there isn't a decent ditch for miles around. Make your move while you've got your chance, is my advice to you. I'll be at the Tangiers Club in half an hour. She pulled on her shoes and coat, paused when she remembered that it was Thursday and that she should put a fresh, extra-long tape on the answering machine, and 2 minutes later was out of the front door. When at last the phone did ring, the answering machine said sweetly that Susan Way could not come to the phone just at the moment, but that if the caller would like to leave a message, she would get back to them as soon as possible. Maybe. Chapter 4. It was a chill November evening of the old-fashioned type. The moon looked pale and wan, as if it shouldn't be up on a night like this. It rose unwillingly and hung like an ill spectre. Silhouetted against it, dim and hazy through the dampness which rose from the unwholesome fens, stood the assorted towers and turrets of St. Sed's, Cambridge, a ghostly profusion of buildings thrown up over centuries, medieval next to Victorian, Odeon next to Tudor. Only rising through the mist did they seem remotely to belong to one another. Between them scurried figures, hurrying from one dim pool of light to another, shivering, leaving wraiths of breath which folded themselves into the cold night behind them. It was 7 o'clock. Many of the figures were heading for the college dining hall, which divided first court from second court, and from which warm light reluctantly streamed. 2 figures in particular seemed ill-matched. One, a young man, was tall, thin, and angular. Even muffled inside a heavy, dark coat, he walked a little like an affronted heron. The other was small, roundish, and moved with an ungainly restlessness, like a number of elderly squirrels trying to escape from a sack. His own age was on the older side of completely indeterminate. If you picked a number at random, he was probably a little older than that, but, well, it was impossible to tell. Certainly his face was heavily lined, and the small amount of hair that escaped from under his red woollen skiing hat was thin, white, and had very much its own ideas about how it wished to arrange itself. He, too, was muffled inside a heavy coat, but over it he wore a billowing gown with a very faded purple trim, the badge of his unique and peculiar academic office. As they walked, the older man was doing all the talking. He was pointing at items of interest along the way, despite the fact that it was too dark to see any of them. The younger man was saying, "Oh, yes, and really, how interesting, and well, 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 and good heavens." His head bobbed seriously. They entered not through the main entrance to the hall, but through a small doorway on the east side of the court. This led to the senior combination room and a dark-panelled ante-room where the fellows of the college assembled to slap their hands and make brrr noises before making their way through their own entrance to the high table. They were late and shook off their coats hurriedly. This was complicated for the older man by the necessity first of taking off his professorial gown, then of putting it back on again once his coat was off, then of stuffing his hat in his coat pocket, then of wondering where he'd put his scarf, and then of realizing that he hadn't brought it, then of fishing in his coat pocket for his handkerchief, then of fishing in his other coat pocket for his spectacles, and finally of finding them, quite unexpectedly, wrapped in his scarf, which it turned out he had brought after all, but hadn't been wearing, despite the damp and bitter wind blowing in like a witch's breath from across the fens. He bustled the younger man into the hall ahead of him, and they took the last 2 vacant seats at the high table, braving a flurry of frowns and raised eyebrows for interrupting the Latin grace to do so. Hall was full tonight. It was always more popular with the undergraduates in the colder months. More unusually, the hall was candlelit, which it was now only on very special occasions. 2 long, crowded tables stretched off into the glimmering darkness. By candlelight, people's faces were more alive. The hushed sound of their voices, the clink of cutlery and glasses seemed more exciting. And in the dark recesses of the great hall, all the centuries for which it had existed seemed present at once. High table itself formed a crosspiece at the top, and was raised about a foot above the rest. Since it was a guest night, the table was set on both sides to accommodate the extra numbers, and many diners therefore sat with their backs to the rest of the hall. "So, young Macduff," said the Professor, once he was seated and flapping his napkin open, "pleasure to see you again, my dear fellow. Glad you could come. No idea what all this is about," he added, peering round the hall in consternation. "All the candles and silver and business? Generally means a special dinner in honour of someone or something no one can remember anything about, except that it means better food for a night." He paused and thought for a moment, and then said, "Seems odd, don't you think, that the quality of the food should vary inversely with the brightness of the lighting? Makes you wonder what culinary heights the kitchen staff could rise to if you confined them to perpetual darkness. Could be worth a try, I think. Got some good vaults in the college that could be turned over to the purpose. I think I showed you round them once. Nice brickwork." All this came as something of relief to his guest. It was the first indication his host had given that he had the faintest recollection of who he was. Professor Urban Chronotis, the Regius Professor of Chronology, or Reg, as he insisted on being called, had a memory that he himself had once compared to the Queen Alexandra Birdwing butterfly, in that it was colourful, flitted prettily hither and thither, and was now, alas, almost completely extinct. When he had telephoned with the invitation a few days previously, he had seemed extremely keen to see his former pupil, and yet when Richard had arrived this evening, a little on the late side, admittedly, the Professor had thrown open the door, apparently in anger, had started in surprise on seeing Richard, demanded to know if he was having emotional problems, reacted in annoyance to being reminded gently that it was now 10 years since he had been Richard's college tutor, and finally agreed that Richard had indeed come for dinner. Whereupon he, the Professor, had started talking rapidly and at length about the history of the college architecture, a sure sign that his mind was elsewhere entirely. Reg had never actually taught Richard. He had only been his college tutor, which meant, in short, that he had had charge of his general welfare, told him when the exams were, not to take drugs, and so on. Indeed, it was not entirely clear if Reg had ever taught anybody at all, and what, if anything, he would have taught them. His professorship was an obscure one, to say the least, and since he dispensed with his lecturing duties by the simple and time-honoured technique of presenting all his potential students with an exhaustive list of books that he knew for a fact had been out of print for 30 years, then flying into a tantrum if they failed to find them, no one had ever discovered the precise nature of his academic discipline. He had, of course, long ago taken the precaution of removing the only extant copies of the books on his reading list from the university and college libraries, as a result of which he had plenty of time to, well, to do whatever it was he did. Since Richard had always managed to get on reasonably well with the old fruitcake, he had one day plucked up courage to ask him what, exactly, the Regius Professorship of Chronology was. It had been one of those light summery days when the world seems about to burst with pleasure at simply being itself, and Reg had been in an uncharacteristically forthcoming mood as they had walked over the bridge where the River Cam divided the older parts of the college from the newer. "Sinecure, my dear fellow, an absolute sinecure," he had beamed. "A small amount of money for a very small, or shall we say, non-existent amount of work. That puts me permanently just ahead of the game, which is a comfortable, if frugal, place to spend your life. I recommend it." He leaned over the edge of the bridge and started to point out a particular brick that he found interesting. "But what sort of study is it supposed to be?" Richard had pursued. Is it history? Physics? Philosophy? What?" "Well," said Red slowly, "since you're interested, the chair was originally instituted by King George III, who, as you know, entertained a number of amusing notions, including the belief that one of the trees in Windsor Great Park was in fact Frederick the Great. It was his own appointment, hence Regis, his own idea as well, which is somewhat more unusual. Sunlight played along the River Cam. People in punts happily shouted at each other to fuck off. Thin natural scientists, who had spent months locked away in their rooms, growing white and fish-like, emerged blinking into the light. Couples walking along the bank got so excited about the general wonderfulness of it all that they had to pop inside for an hour. The poor beleaguered fellow," Reg continued, "George III, I mean, was, as you may know, obsessed with time, filled the palace with clocks, wound them incessantly, sometimes would get up in the middle of the night and prowl around the palace in his nightshirt, winding clocks. He was very concerned that time continued to go forward, you see. So many terrible things had occurred in his life that he was terrified that any of them might happen again if time were ever allowed to slip backwards, even for a moment. A very understandable fear, especially if you're barking mad, as I'm afraid to say, with the very greatest sympathy for the poor fellow he undoubtedly was. He appointed me, or rather I should say my office, this professorship, you understand, the post I'm now privileged to hold to, where was I? Oh yes, he instituted this chair of chronology to see if there was any particular reason why one thing happened after another, and if there was any way of stopping it. Since the answers to the three questions were, I knew immediately, yes, no, and maybe, I realised that I could then take the rest of my career off. And your predecessors? Asked Richard. Were much of the same mind. But who were they? Well, splendid fellows, of course. Splendid to a man. Remind me to tell you about them one day. See that brick? Wordsworth was once sick on that brick. Great man. All that had been about 10 years ago. Richard glanced around the great dining hall to see what had changed in the time, and the answer was, of course, absolutely nothing. In the dark heights, dimly seen by the flickering candlelight, were the ghostly portraits of prime ministers, archbishops, political reformers, and poets, any of whom might, in their day, have been sick on that same brick. "Well," said Reg in a loudly confidential whisper, as if introducing the subject of nipple piercing in a nunnery, "I hear you've suddenly done very well for yourself at last, hm?" "Well, yes, in fact," said Richard, who was as surprised at the fact as anybody else. "Yes, I have." Around the table, several gazes stiffened on him. Computers, he heard somebody whisper dismissively to a neighbour further down the table. The stiff gazes relaxed again and turned away. "Excellent," said Reg. "I'm so pleased for you, so pleased. Tell me," he went on, and it was a moment before Richard realised that the professor wasn't talking to him any more, but had turned to the right to address his other neighbour. "What's all this about, he flourished a vague hand over the candles and college silver, stuff?" His neighbour, an elderly wizened figure, turned very slowly and looked at him as if he was rather annoyed at being raised from the dead like this. "Coleridge," he said in a thin rasp. "It's the Coleridge dinner, you old fool." He turned very slowly back until he was facing the front again. His name was Corley. He was a professor of archaeology and anthropology, and it was frequently said of him, behind his back, that he regarded it not so much as a serious academic study, more as a chance to relive his childhood. "Ah, is it?" murmured Reg, "is it?" and turned back to Richard. "It's the Coleridge dinner," he said knowledgeably. "Coleridge was a member of the college, you know," he added after a moment. "Coleridge, Samuel Taylor, a poet. Expect you've heard of him. This is his dinner. Well, not literally, of course. It would be cold by now." Silence. "Here, have some salt." "Thank you. I think I'll wait," said Richard, surprised. There was no food on the table yet. Go on, take it," insisted the professor, proffering him the heavy silver salt cellar. Richard blinked in bemusement, but with an interior shrug he reached to take it. In the moment that he blinked, however, the salt cellar had completely vanished. He started back in surprise. "A good one, eh?" said Reg, as he retrieved the missing cruet from behind the ear of his deathly right-hand neighbour, provoking a surprisingly girlish giggle from somewhere else at the table. Reg smiled impishly. "Very irritating habit, I know. It's next on my list for giving up after smoking and leeches." Well, that was another thing that hadn't changed. Some people picked their noses, others habitually beat up old ladies on the streets. Reg's vice was a harmless, if peculiar one, an addiction to childish conjuring tricks. Richard remembered the first time he had been to see Reg with a problem. It was only the normal angst that periodically takes undergraduates into its grip, particularly when they have essays to write, but it had seemed a dark and savage weight at the time. Reg had sat and listened to his outpourings with a deep frown of concentration, and when at last Richard had finished, he pondered seriously, stroked his chin a lot, and at last leaned forward and looked him in the eye. "I suspect that your problem," he said, "is that you have too many paper clips up your nose." Richard stared at him. "Allow me to demonstrate," said Reg, and leaning across the desk, he pulled from Richard's nose a chain of 11 paper clips and a small rubber swan. "Ah, the real culprit," he said, holding up the swan. "They come in cereal packets, you know, and cause no end of trouble. Well, I'm glad we've had this little chat, my dear fellow. Please feel free to disturb me again if you have any more such problems." Needless to say, Richard didn't. Richard glanced around the table to see if there was anybody else he recognised from his time at the college. Two places away to the left was the Don who had been Richard's Director of Studies in English, who showed no signs of recognising him at all. This was hardly surprising, since Richard had spent his 3 years here assiduously avoiding him, often to the extent of growing a beard and pretending to be someone else. Next to him was a man whom Richard had never managed to identify. Neither, in fact, had anyone else. He was thin and vole-like, and had the most extraordinarily long, bony nose. It really was very, very long and bony indeed. In fact, it looked a lot like the controversial keel which had helped the Australians win the America's Cup in 1983, and this resemblance had been much remarked upon at the time, though not, of course, to his face. No one had said anything to his face at all. No one. Ever. Anyone meeting him for the first time was too startled and embarrassed by his nose to speak, and the second time was worse because of the first time, and so on. Years had gone by now, 17 in all. In all that time he had been cocooned in silence. In hall it had long been the habit of the college servants to position a separate set of salt, pepper, and mustard on either side of him, since no one could ask him to pass them. And to ask someone sitting on the other side of him was not only rude but completely impossible, because of his nose being in the way. The other odd thing about him was a series of gestures he made, and repeated regularly throughout every evening. They consisted of tapping each of the fingers of his left hand in order, and then one of the fingers of his right hand. He would then occasionally tap some other part of his body, a knuckle, an elbow, or a knee. Whenever he was forced to stop this by the requirements of eating, he would start blinking each of his eyes instead, and occasionally nodding. No one, of course, had ever dared to ask him why he did this, though all were consumed with curiosity. Richard couldn't see who was sitting beyond him. In the other direction, beyond Reg's deathly neighbour, was Watkin, the classics professor, a man of terrifying dryness and oddity. His heavy, rimless glasses were almost solid cubes of glass, within which his eyes appeared to lead independent existences, like goldfish. His nose was straight enough and ordinary, but beneath it he wore the same beard as Clint Eastwood. His eyes gazed swimmingly around the table as he selected who was going to be spoken at tonight. He had thought that his prey might be one of the guests, the newly appointed head of Radio 3, who was sitting opposite, but unfortunately he had already been ensnared by the music director of the college and a professor of philosophy. These two were busy explaining to the harassed man that the phrase "too much Mozart" was, given any reasonable definition of those three words, an inherently self-contradictory expression, and that any sentence which contained such a phrase would be thereby rendered meaningless and could not, consequently, be advanced as part of an argument in favour of any given programme scheduling strategy. The poor man was already beginning to grip his cutlery too tightly. His eyes darted about desperately looking for rescue, and made the mistake of lighting on those of Watkin. "Good evening," said Watkin with smiling charm, nodding in the most friendly way and then letting his gaze settle glassily onto his bowl of newly arrived soup, from which position it would not allow itself to be moved. Yet, let the bugger suffer a little. He wanted the rescue to be worth at least a good half dozen radio talk fees. Beyond Watkin, Richard suddenly discovered the source of the little girlish giggle that had greeted Reg's conjuring trick. Astonishingly enough, it was a little girl. She was about 8 years old, with blonde hair and a glum look. She was sitting, occasionally kicking pettishly at the table leg. "Who's that?" Richard asked Reg in surprise. "Who's what?" Reg asked Richard in surprise. Richard inclined a finger surreptitiously in her direction. "The girl," he whispered. "The very, very little girl. Is it some new maths professor?" Reg peered round at her. "Do you know," he said in astonishment, "I haven't the faintest idea. Never known anything like it. How extraordinary." At that moment the problem was solved by the man from the BBC, who suddenly wrenched himself out of the logical half-Nelson into which his neighbours had got him, and told the girl off for kicking the table. She stopped kicking the table, and instead kicked the air with redoubled vigour. He told her to try and enjoy herself, so she kicked him. This did something to bring a brief glimmer of pleasure into her glum evening, but it didn't last. Her father briefly shared with the table at large his feelings about babysitters who let people down, but nobody felt able to run with the topic. "A major season of books to Huda," resumed the director of music, "is, of course, clearly long overdue. I'm sure you'll be looking forward to remedying the situation at the first opportunity." Oh, yes, replied the girl's father, spilling his soup. He's not the same one as Gluck, is he?" The little girl kicked the table leg again. When her father looked sternly at her, she put her head on one side and mouthed the question at him. "Not now," he insisted at her as quietly as he could. "When, then?" "Later, maybe. Later, we'll see." She hunched grumpily back in her seat. "You always say later," she mouthed at him. Poor child, murmured Reg. There isn't a don at this table who doesn't behave exactly like that inside. Ah, thank you. Their soup arrived, distracting his attention and Richard's. So tell me, said Reg, after they'd both had a couple of spoonsful and arrived independently at the same conclusion, that it was not a taste explosion, what you've been up to, my dear chap, something to do with computers, I understand, and also to do with music? I thought you read English when you were here, though only, I realise, in your spare time. He looked at Richard significantly over the rim of his soup spoon. Now wait, he interrupted before Richard even had a chance to start. Don't I vaguely remember that you had some sort of computer when you were here? When was it, in 1977? Well, what we called a computer in 1977, said Richard, was really kind of electric abacus, but... Oh, now, don't underestimate the abacus, said Reg. In skilled hands, it's a very sophisticated calculating device. Furthermore, it requires no power, can be made with any materials you have to hand, and never goes bing in the middle of an important piece of work. So an electric one would be particularly pointless, said Richard. True enough, conceded Reg. There really wasn't a lot this machine could do that you couldn't do for yourself in half the time and with a lot less trouble, said Richard. But it was, on the other hand, very good at being a slow and dim-witted pupil. Reg looked at him quizzically. I had no idea they were supposed to be in short supply, he said. I could hit a dozen with a bread roll from where I'm sitting. Oh, I'm sure, said Richard, but look at it this way. What really is the point of trying to teach anything to anybody? This question seemed to provoke a murmur of sympathetic approval from up and down the table. Richard continued, What I mean is that if you really want to understand something, the best way is to try and explain it to someone else. That forces you to sort it out in your own mind, and the more slow and dim-witted your pupil, the more you have to break things down into more and more simple ideas. And that's really the essence of programming. By the time you've sorted out a complicated idea into little steps that even a stupid machine can deal with, you've certainly learned something about it yourself. The teacher usually learns more than the pupil, isn't that true? It would be hard to learn much less than my pupils, came a low growl from somewhere on the table, without undergoing a prefrontal lobotomy. So I used to spend days struggling to write essays on this 16K machine that would have taken a couple of hours on a typewriter. But what was fascinating to me was the process of trying to explain to the machine what it was I wanted it to do. I virtually wrote my own word processor in BASIC. A simple search and replace routine would take about 3 hours. I forget, said Reg. Did you ever get any essays done at all? Well, not as such, said Richard. I mean, not actual essays, but the reasons why not were absolutely fascinating. For instance, I discovered that... He broke off, laughing at himself. I was also playing keyboards in a rock group, of course, he added. That didn't help. Now, that I didn't know, said Reg. Your past has murkier things in it than I dreamed possible. A quality, I might add, that it shares with the soup. He wiped his mouth with his napkin very carefully. I must go and have a word with the kitchen staff one day. I would like to be sure that they're keeping the right bits and throwing the proper bits away. So, a rock group, you say? Well, 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 good heavens. Yes, said Richard, we called ourselves the Reasonably Good Band, but in fact we weren't. Our intention was to be the Beatles of the early 80s, but we got much better financial and legal advice than the Beatles ever did, which was basically, don't bother, so we didn't. I left Cambridge and starved for 3 years. But didn't I bump into you during that period, said Reg, and you said you were doing very well. As a road sweeper, yes, there was an awful lot of mess on the roads, more than enough, I felt, to support an entire career. However, I got the sack for sweeping the mess onto another sweeper's patch. Reg shook his head. The wrong career for you, I'm sure. There are plenty of occasions where such behaviour will ensure rapid preferment. I tried a few, said Richard, none of them much grander, though, and I kept none of them very long because I was always too tired to do them properly. I'd be found asleep slumped over the chicken sheds or filing cabinets, depending on what the job was. Been up all night with the computer, you see, teaching it to play Three Blind Mice. It was an important goal for me. I'm sure, agreed Reg. Thank you, he said to the college servant, who took his half-finished plate of soup from him. Thank you very much. Three Blind Mice, eh? Good, good. So, no doubt you succeeded eventually, and this accounts for your present celebrated status, yes? Well, there's a bit more to it than that. I feared there might be. Pity you didn't bring it with you, though. It might have cheered up the poor young lady who is currently having our dull and crusty company forced upon her. Swift bursts of Three Blind Mice would probably do much to revive her spirits. He leaned forward to look past his two right-hand neighbours at the girl, who was still sitting sagging in her chair. Hello, he said. She looked up in surprise, then dropped her eyes shyly, swinging her legs again. "Which do you think is worse?" inquired Reg. "The soup or the company?" She gave a tiny, reluctant laugh and shrugged, still looking down. "I think you're very wise not to commit yourself at this stage," continued Reg. "Myself, I'm waiting to see the carrots before I make any judgments. They've been boiling them since the weekend, but I fear that may not be long enough. The only thing that could possibly be worse than the carrots is Watkin. He's the man with the silly glasses sitting between us. My name's Reg, by the way. Come over and kick me when you have a moment." The girl giggled and glanced up at Watkin, who stiffened and made an appallingly unsuccessful attempt to smile good-naturedly. "Well, little girl," he said to her awkwardly, and she had desperately to suppress a hoot of laughter at his glasses. Little conversation, therefore, ensued, but the girl had an ally and began to enjoy herself a tiny little bit. Her father gave her a relieved smile. Reg turned back to Richard, who said suddenly, "Do you have any family?"
No, said Reg quietly. "But tell me, after three blind mice, what then?"
Well, to cut a long story short, Reg, I ended up working for Wayforward Technologies.
Ah, yes, the famous Mr. Way. Tell me, what's he like?
Richard was always faintly annoyed by this question, probably because he was asked it so often.
Well, both better and worse than is represented in the press. I like him a lot, actually. Like any driven man, he can be a bit trying at times. But I've known him since the early days of the company, when neither he nor I had a bean to our names.
He's fine. It's just that it's a good idea not to let him have your telephone number, unless you possess an industrial-grade answering machine.
A what? Why's that?
Well, he's one of those people who can only think when he's talking. When he has ideas, he has to talk them out to whoever will listen. Or if the people themselves are not available, which is increasingly the case, their answering machines will do just as well. He just phones them up and talks at them. He has one secretary whose sole job it is to collect tapes from the people he might have phoned, transcribe them, sort them, and give him the edited text the next day in a blue folder.
A blue one, eh?
Ask me why he doesn't simply use a tape recorder, said Richard with a shrug. Reg considered this.
I expect he doesn't use a tape recorder because he doesn't like talking to himself, he said.
There is a logic there, of a kind. He took a mouthful of his newly arrived porc au poivre and ruminated on it for a while before gently laying his knife and fork aside again for the moment.
So what, he said at last, is the role of young Macduff in all this?
Well, Gordon assigned me to write a major piece of software for the Apple Macintosh. Financial spreadsheet, accounting, that sort of thing. Powerful, easy to use, lots of graphics. I asked him exactly what he wanted in it, and he just said, "Everything. I want the top piece of all-singing, all-dancing business software for that machine." And being of a slightly whimsical turn of mind, I took him literally. You see, a pattern of numbers can represent anything you like, can be used to map any surface or modulate any dynamic process, and so on. And any set of company accounts are, in the end, just a pattern of numbers. So I sat down and wrote a program that'll take those numbers and do what you like with them. If you just want a bar graph, it'll do them as a bar graph. If you want them as a pie chart or a scatter graph, it'll do them as a pie chart or scatter graph. If you want dancing girls jumping out of the pie chart in order to distract attention from the figures the pie chart actually represents, then the program will do that as well. Or you can turn your figures into, for instance, a flock of seagulls, and the formation they fly in and the way in which the wings of each gull beat will be determined by the performance of each division of your company. Great for producing animated corporate logos that actually mean something. But the silliest feature of all was that if you wanted your company accounts represented as a piece of music, it could do that as well. Well, I thought it was silly. The corporate world went bananas over it. Reg regarded him solemnly from over a piece of carrot, poised delicately on his fork in front of him, but did not interrupt.
You see, any aspect of a piece of music can be expressed as a sequence or pattern of numbers, enthused Richard. Numbers can express the pitch of notes, the length of notes, patterns of pitches and lengths.
You mean tunes, said Reg. The carrot had not yet moved. Richard grinned.
Tunes would be a very good word for it. I must remember that.
It would help you speak more easily. Reg returned the carrot to his plate, untasted.
And this software did well, then? He asked.
Not so much here. The yearly accounts of most British companies emerged sounding like the Dead March from Saul. But in Japan, they went for it like a pack of rats. It produced lots of cheery company anthems that started well, but if you were going to criticize them, you'd probably say they tended to get a bit loud and squeaky at the end. Did spectacular business in the States, which was the main thing, commercially. Though the thing that's interesting me most now is what happens if you leave the accounts out of it. Turn the numbers that represent the way a swallow's wings beat directly into music. What would you hear? Not the sound of cash registers, according to Gordon.
Fascinating, said Reg, quite fascinating, and popped the carrot at last into his mouth.
He turned and leaned forward to speak to his new girlfriend.
Watkin loses, he pronounced. The carrots have achieved a new all-time low. Sorry, Watkin, but awful as you are, the carrots, I'm afraid, are world-beaters. The girl giggled more easily than last time, and she smiled at him. Watkin was trying to take all this good-naturedly, but it was clear, as his eyes swam at Reg, that he was more used to discomforting than being discomforted. "Please, Daddy, can I now?" With her newfound, if slight, confidence, the girl had also found a voice. "Later," insisted her father. "This is already later. I've been timing it." "Well," he hesitated, and was lost. "We've been to Greece," announced the girl in a small but awed voice. "Ah, have you indeed?" said Watkin with a little nod. "Well, well, anywhere in particular, or just Greece generally?" "Patmos," she said decisively. "It was beautiful. I think Patmos is the most beautiful place in the whole world, except the ferry never came when it said it would. Never, ever. I timed it. We missed our flight, but I didn't mind." "Ah, Patmos, I see," said Watkin, who was clearly roused by the news. "Well, what you have to understand, young lady, is that the Greeks, not content with dominating the culture of the classical world, are also responsible for the greatest, some would say the only, work of true creative imagination produced this century as well. I refer, of course, to the Greek ferry timetables, a work of the sublimest fiction. Anyone who has travelled in the Aegean will confirm this." "Yes, I think so." She frowned at him. "I've found a pot," she said. "Probably nothing," interrupted her father hastily. "You know the way it is. Everyone who goes to Greece for the first time thinks they've found a pot, don't they?" There were general nods. This was true. Irritating, but true. "I found it in the harbour," she said. "In the water. While we were waiting for the damn ferry. Sarah, I've told you. It's just what you called it, and worse. You called it words I didn't think you knew. Anyway, I thought that if everyone here was meant to be so clever, then someone would be able to tell me if it was a proper ancient Greek thing or not. I think it's very old. Will you please let them see it, Daddy?" Her father shrugged hopelessly and started to fish about under his chair. "Did you know, young lady," said Watkin to her, "that the Book of Revelation was written on Patmos? It was indeed, by St. John the Divine, as you know. To me it shows very clear signs of having been written while waiting for a ferry. Oh, yes, I think so. It starts off, doesn't it, with that kind of dreaminess you get when you're killing time, getting bored, you know, just making things up, and then gradually grows to a sort of climax of hallucinatory despair. I find that very suggestive. Perhaps you should write a paper on it." He nodded at her. She looked at him as if he were mad. Well, here it is," said her father, plonking the thing down on the table. "Just a pot, as you see. She's only 6, he added with a grim smile. "Aren't you, dear?" 7, said Sarah. The pot was quite small, about 5 inches high and 4 inches across at its widest point. The body was almost spherical, with a very narrow neck extending about 1 inch above the body. The neck and about half of the surface area were encrusted with hard caked earth, but the parts of the pot that could be seen were of a rough, ruddy texture. Sarah took it and thrust it into the hands of the Don sitting on her right. "You look clever," she said. "Tell me what you think." The Don took it and turned it over with a slightly supercilious air. "I'm sure if you scraped away the mud from the bottom," he remarked wittedly, "it would probably say made in Birmingham." "Oh, that old," said Sarah's father with a forced laugh. "Long time since anything was made there." "Anyway," said the Don, "not my field. I'm a molecular biologist. Anyone else want to have a look?" This question was not greeted with wild yelps of enthusiasm, but nevertheless the pot was passed from hand to hand around the far end of the table in a desultory fashion. It was goggled at through pebble glasses, peered at through horn rims, gazed at over half moons, and squinted at by someone who had left his glasses in his other suit, which he very much feared had now gone to the cleaners. No one seemed to know how old it was, or to care very much. The young girl's face began to grow downhearted again. "Sour lot," said Reg to Richard. He picked up a silver salt cellar again and held it up. "Young lady," he said, leaning forward to address her. "Oh, not again, you old fool," muttered the aged archaeologist Corley, sitting back and putting his hands over his ears. "Young lady," repeated Reg, "regard this simple silver salt cellar. Regard this simple hat." "You haven't got a hat," said the girl sulkily. "Oh," said Reg, "a moment, please," and he went and fetched his woolly red one. "Regard," he said again, "the simple silver salt cellar. Regard the simple woolly hat. I put the salt cellar in the hat thus, and I pass the hat to you. The next part of the trick, dear lady, is up to you." He handed the hat to her, passed their two intervening neighbours, Corley and Watkin. She took the hat and looked inside it. "Where's it gone?" she asked, staring into the hat. "It's wherever you put it," said Reg. "Oh," said Sarah. "I see. Well, that wasn't very good." Reg shrugged. "A simple trick, but it gives me pleasure," he said, and turned back to Richard. "Now, what were we talking about?" Richard looked at him with a slight sense of shock. He knew that the professor had always been prone to sudden and erratic mood swings, but it was as if all the warmth had drained out of him in an instant. He now wore the same distracted expression Richard had seen on his face when first he had arrived at his door that evening, apparently completely unexpected. Reg seemed then to sense that Richard was taken aback and quickly reassembled a smile. "My dear chap," he said, "my dear chap, my dear, dear chap. What was I saying?" "You were saying, my dear chap." Yes, but I feel sure it was a prelude to something, a sort of short toccata on the theme of what a splendid fellow you are prior to introducing the main subject to my discourse, the nature of which I currently forget. You have no idea what I was about to say?" "No," said Richard. "Oh, well, I suppose I should be pleased. If everyone knew exactly what I was going to say, there'd be no point in saying it, would there? Now, how's our young guest's pot doing?" In fact, it had reached Watkin, who pronounced himself no expert on what the ancients had made for themselves to drink out of, only on what they had written as the result. He said that Corley was the one to whose knowledge and experience they should all bow, and attempted to give the pot to him. "I said," he repeated, "yours was the knowledge and experience to which we should bow. Oh, for heaven's sake, take your hands off your ears and have a look at the thing." Gently but firmly, he drew Corley's right hand from his ear, explained the situation to him once again, and handed him the pot. Corley gave it a cursory but clearly expert examination. "Yes," he said, "about 200 years old, I would think. Very rough, very crude example of its type, utterly without value, of course." He put it down peremptorily and gazed off into the old minstrel gallery, which appeared to anger him for some reason. The effect on Sarah was immediate. Already discouraged, she was thoroughly downcast by this. She bit her lip and threw herself back against her chair, feeling once again thoroughly out of place and childish. Her father gave her a warning look about misbehaving and then apologised for her again. "Well, Buxtehude," he carried on to say. "Yes, good old Buxtehude. We'll have to see what we can do. Tell me, young lady," interrupted a voice, hoarse with astonishment. "You are clearly a magician and enchantress of prodigious powers." All eyes turned to Reg, the old show-off. He was gripping the pot and staring at it with manic fascination. He turned his eyes slowly to the little girl, as if for the first time assessing the power of a feared adversary. "I bow to you," he whispered. "I, unworthy though I am to speak in the presence of such a power as yours, beg leave to congratulate you on one of the finest feats of the conjurer's art it has been my privilege to witness." Sarah stared at him with widening eyes. "May I show these people what you have wrought?" he asked earnestly. Very faintly she nodded, and he fetched her formerly precious but now sadly discredited pot, a sharp rap on the table. It split into two irregular parts, the caked clay with which it was surrounded falling in jagged shards on the table. One side of the pot fell away, leaving the rest standing. Sarah's eyes goggled at the stained and tarnished, but clearly recognisable, Silver College salt cellar standing jammed in the remains of the pot. "Stupid old fool," muttered Corley. The general disparagement and condemnation of this cheap parlour trick had died down, none of which could dim the awe in Sarah's eyes. Reg turned to Richard and said idly, "Who was that friend of yours when you were here? Do you ever see him? A chap with an odd East European name, a Sflad something, a Sfladcelli, remember the fellow?" Richard looked at him blankly for a moment. "Sflad," he said. "Oh, you mean Dirk, Dirk Chaley. Well, no, I've never stayed in touch. I've bumped into him a couple of times in the street, but that's all. I think he changes his name from time to time. Why do you ask?" Chapter 5. High on his rocky promontory, the electric monk continued to sit on a horse which was going quietly and uncomplainingly spare. From under its rough, woven cowl, the monk gazed unblinkingly down into the valley, with which it was having a problem. But the problem was a new and hideous one to the monk, for it was this: doubt. He never suffered it for long, but when he did, it gnawed the very root of his being. The day was hot. The sun stood in an empty, hazy sky and beat down upon the grey rocks and the scrubby, parched grass. Nothing moved, not even the monk. But strange things were beginning to fizz in its brain, as they did from time to time when a piece of data became misaddressed as it passed through its input buffer. But then the monk began to believe, fitfully and nervously at first, but then with a great searing white flame of belief which overturned all previous beliefs, including the stupid one about the valley being pink, that somewhere down in the valley, about a mile from where he was sitting, there would shortly open up a mysterious doorway into a strange and distant world, a doorway through which he might enter. An astounding idea. Astoundingly enough, however, on this one occasion, he was perfectly right. The horse sensed that something was up. It pricked up its ears and gently shook its head. It had gone into a sort of trance, looking at the same clump of rocks for so long, and was on the verge of imagining them to be pink itself. It shook its head a little harder. A slight twitch on the reins and a prod from the monk's heels, and they were off, picking their way carefully down the rocky incline. The way was difficult. Much of it was loose shale, loose brown and grey shale, with the occasional brown and green plant clinging to a precarious existence on it. The monk noticed this without embarrassment. It was an older, wiser monk now, and had put childish things behind it. Pink valleys, hermaphrodite tables, these are all natural stages through which one had to pass on the path to true enlightenment. The sun beat hard on them. The monk wiped the sweat and dust off its face and paused, leaning forward on the horse's neck. It peered down through the shimmering heat haze at a large outcrop of rock which stood out onto the floor of the valley. There, behind that outcrop, was where the monk thought, or rather passionately believed to the core of its being, the door would appear. It tried to focus more closely, but the details of the view swam confusingly in the hot rising air. As it sat back in its saddle and was about to prod the horse onward, it suddenly noticed a rather odd thing. On a flattish wall of rock nearby, in fact so nearby that the monk was surprised not to have noticed it before, was a large painting. The painting was crudely drawn, though not without a certain stylish sweep of line, and seemed very old, possibly very, very old indeed. The paint was faded, chipped, and patchy, and it was difficult to discern with any clarity what the picture was. The monk approached the picture more closely. It looked like a primitive hunting scene. The group of purple, multi-limbed creatures were clearly early hunters. They carried rough spears and were in hot pursuit of a large, horned and armoured creature, which appeared to have been wounded in the hunt already. The colours were now so dim as to be almost non-existent. In fact, all that could be clearly seen was the white of the hunter's teeth, which seemed to shine with a whiteness whose lustre was undimmed by the passage of what must have been many thousands of years. In fact, they even put the monk's own teeth to shame, and he'd cleaned them only that morning. The monk had seen paintings like this before, but only in pictures or on the TV, never in real life. They were usually to be found in caves, where they were protected from the elements, otherwise they would not have survived. The monk looked more carefully at the immediate environs of the rock wall, and noticed that, though not exactly in a cave, it was nevertheless protected by a large overhang and was well sheltered from the wind and rain. Odd, though, that it should have managed to last so long. Odder still that it should appear not to have been discovered. Such cave paintings as there were all famous and familiar images, but this was not one that he had ever seen before. Perhaps this was a dramatic and historic find he had made. Perhaps if he were to return to the city and announce this discovery, he would be welcomed back, given a new motherboard after all, and allowed to believe... believe what? He paused, blinked, and shook his head to clear a momentary system error. He pulled himself up short. He believed in a door. He must find that door. The door was the way to... The door was the way. Good. Capital letters are always the best way of dealing with things you didn't have a good answer to. Briskly, he tugged the horse's head round and urged it onward and downward. Within a few minutes more of tricky manoeuvring, they had reached the valley floor, and he was momentarily disconcerted to discover that the fine top layer of dust that had settled on the brown parched earth was indeed a very pale brownish pink, particularly on the banks of the sluggish trickle of mud, which was all that remained in the hot season, of the river that flowed through the valley when the rains came. He dismounted and bent down to feel the pink dust and run it through his fingers. It was very fine and soft and felt pleasant as he rubbed it on his skin. It was about the same colour, perhaps a little paler. The horse was looking at him. He realized, a little belatedly perhaps, that the horse must be extremely thirsty. He was extremely thirsty himself, but had tried to keep his mind off it. He unbuckled the water flask from the saddle. It was pathetically light. He unscrewed the top and took one single swig. Then he poured a little into his cupped hand and offered it to the horse, who slurped at it greedily and briefly.
the horse looked at him again. The monk shook his head sadly, resealed the bottle and replaced it. He knew, in that small part of his mind where he kept factual and logical information, that it would not last much longer, and that without it, neither would they. It was only his belief that kept him going, currently his belief in the door. He brushed the pink dust from his rough habit, and then stood looking at the rocky outcrop a mere 100 yards distant. He looked at it not without a slight, tiny trepidation, although the major part of his mind was firm in its eternal and unshakable belief that there would be a door behind the outcrop, and that the door would be the way. Yet the tiny part of his brain that understood about the water bottle could not help but recall past disappointments, and sounded a very tiny but jarring note of caution. If he elected not to go and see the door for himself, then he would continue to believe in it forever. It would be the lodestone of his life. What little was left of it, said the part of his brain that knew about the water bottle. If, on the other hand, he went to pay his respects to the door, and it wasn't there, what then? The horse whinnied impatiently. The answer, of course, was very simple. He had a whole board of circuits for dealing with exactly this problem. In fact, this was the very heart of his function. He would continue to believe in it, whatever the facts turned out to be. What else was the meaning of belief? The door would still be there, even if the door was not. He pulled himself together. The door would be there, and he must now go to it, because the door was the way. Instead of remounting his horse, he led it. The way was but a short way, and he should enter the presence of the door in humility. He walked, brave and erect, with solemn slowness. He approached the rocky outcrop. He reached it. He turned the corner. He looked. The door was there. The horse, it must be said, was quite surprised. The monk fell to his knees in awe and bewilderment. So braced was he for dealing with the disappointment that was habitually his lot, that though he would never know to admit it, he was completely unprepared for this. He stared at the door in sheer blank system error. It was a door such as he had never seen before. All the doors he knew were great steel-reinforced things because of all the video recorders and dishwashers that were kept behind them, plus, of course, all the expensive electric monks that were needed to believe in it all. This one was simple, wooden and small, about his own size. A monk-sized door, painted white, with a single slightly dented brass knob, slightly less than halfway up one side. It was set simply in the rock face with no explanation as to its origin or purpose. Hardly knowing how he dared, the poor startled monk staggered to his feet and, leading his horse, walked nervously forward towards it. He reached out and touched it. He was so startled when no alarms went off that he jumped back. He touched it again, more firmly this time. He let his hand drop slowly to the handle. Again, no alarms. He waited to be sure, and then he turned it very, very gently. He felt a mechanism release. He held his breath. Nothing. He drew the door towards him, and it came easily. He looked inside, but the interior was so dim in contrast with the desert sun outside that he could see nothing. At last, almost dead with wonder, he entered, pulling the horse in after him. A few minutes later, a figure that had been sitting out of sight around the next outcrop of rock finished rubbing dust on his face, stood up, stretched his limbs, and made his way back towards the door, patting his clothes as he did so. Chapter 6. In Xanadu did Kublai Khan a stately pleasure dome decree. The reader clearly belonged to the school of thought which holds that a sense of the seriousness or greatness of a poem is best imparted by reading it in a silly voice. He soared and swooped at the words until they seemed to duck and run for cover. Where Alph, the sacred river, ran through caverns measureless to man, down to a sunless sea. Richard relaxed back into his seat. The words were very, very familiar to him, as they could not help but be to any English graduate of St. Sed's College, and they settled easily into his mind. The association of the college with Coleridge was taken very seriously indeed, despite the man's well-known predilection for certain recreational pharmaceuticals, under the influence of which this, his greatest work, was composed in a dream. The entire manuscript was lodged in the safekeeping of the college library, and it was from this itself, on the regular occasion of the Coleridge dinner, that the poem was read. So twice 5 miles of fertile ground with walls and towers were girdled round. And there were gardens bright with sinuous rills, where blossomed many an incense-bearing tree. And here were forests ancient as the hills, enfolding sunny spots of greenery. Richard wondered how long it took. He glanced sideways at his former director of studies and was disturbed by the sturdy purposefulness of his reading posture. The sing-song voice irritated him at first, but after a while it began to lull him instead, and he watched a rivulet of wax seeping over the edge of a candle that was burning low now and throwing a guttering light over the carnage of dinner. But oh, that deep romantic chasm which slanted down the green hill athwart a cedarn cover! A savage place as holy and enchanted as e'er beneath a waning moon was haunted,